This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and thank you for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, and he's Ewan McElraith. And with the sound of sausages sizzling in the background, we're going to take you to a favourite haunt of ours in the northeast. For, well, opinions divided, it's either a picnic or World War III.
We're on the beach at Colliston, one of my favourite locations in Scotland.
This is one of those magical places in Scotland. You drive along, and it's flat and frankly pretty boring. You come to the top of the cliff, and suddenly a magical wee village opens up in front of you. It's an enclosed beach, you've got the pier on one side, the rocks on the other. It is an idyllic place for children as well. We were down a couple of days ago and there was piles of little three-year-olds running about the beach. And what I noticed as I came down, what we all noticed, was there's shoes all over the place.
Yeah. The kids just leave their shoes on the steps so they don't have to get sandy feet back into the house and things.
It's great, but I mean, just that image of those four little clog-like shoes sends a wonderful message about happy children and safe children. It's great. I mean, what a great way to start a programme. Apart from the fact we're in cooking wars, as you suggested.
Well, it's not so much cooking, but picnic wars, because my original intention was to have a sort of like a beach picnic, the kind of thing that I used to enjoy as a child, you know, with proper Scottish food. You know, tea cakes and cremola foam and things, and sausages.
Burnt
and
sausages.
Beans. Burnt sausages. They can't be properly cooked, they must be burnt.
Well, especially if you started with frozen sausages.
Well, it's a minor point. But, you said, all right, I'd rather do a different type of picnic, and you've gone completely nuts.
Well, no, this is just how I'd normally start a morning. We've got whole Scottish langoustines, which are cold at the moment, I've boiled them up. We've got butterfly langoustines done with Thai spices and olive oil. A couple of scallops for everybody, some hot smoked salmon. And I got up this morning, baked some bread. We got tomato and basil focaccia. And a plat with a bit of turmeric in it, just to add a bit of excitement. Some Scottish smoked salmon, mayonnaise. I see you've got the tomato ketchup and some Scottish butter. We are opposite ends of the culinary scale here.
How did you actually find the time to get out of your silk pyjamas and feed the peacocks and sweep up the tennis courts and make all that at the same time?
Well, the butler did the rest.
Anyway, Colliston.
No, I'm joking.
Colliston is a fascinating wee place, a former fishing village. To find out more about it, to get some background, we spoke to local historian Elizabeth Hay, and she started off in poetic vein.
There's nae mair shally roadies and nae mair spelden racks, and ye'll nae see bood auld craters, muckle creels upon their backs, nae women sheeling muscles, and naebdy redden lines. There's nae mair dunces in the hall, though we've aye some bonny quines. Ye'll nae see auld Tam Walker, wi' his weather-beaten smile, and ither coothy craters, if we're to wa' as vile. Cote, Bucky, Joggy Mai, Toonie Sot, and Tammy Boo, all Tooley and Jimmicky, to name but just a few. But a' them and the likes o' them have gone and left amiss, and Colliston's just nae the same.
That's from a poem called Nae Fit It Was by a fella called John Robertson. This is Elizabeth Hay. We're standing overlooking the beach at Colliston. I have to say, I actually spent my 18th birthday here because I was on the Scaffy Wagons, they knew how much I loved it, and they dropped me off here for the day with four cans of lager and a piece. I love the place. What's the history of it, though? What was it originally?
Well, fishing is what it started off as, of course, and it's unlike other fishing villages around here because it's almost as if somebody took a handful of chuckies and threw them down and built houses. As you see, they're all sixes and sevens.
Pointing in all directions.
Yeah, that's right. And that gives it its charm, I think.
It's very different from other northeast towns, because usually you get the gable end elements. Yeah. This is very much what you would imagine is a more sensible thing, looking out on the view, or are they just replacement houses?
That's right. But some of them had little windows. Now, you see that one at the corner there's got a little window at the top? Uh-huh. And the bakery also has a little window, gable end to the sea. And they were often used to let the smugglers out at sea know that it was all right to come in, the gaugers weren't around.
There is a connection, and I only found this out this morning, with T.E. Lawrence.
That's
in
correct.
Colliston.
Yes. Well, he came for a holiday.
Lawrence of Arabia.
He didn't call himself, obviously he wasn't Lawrence of Arabia at that time. He called himself by the name of the people that he rented the cottage from. And that house, which has changed, of course, still belongs to the family. And he wrote a letter to his publisher, and that's how we know so much about his visit. And some of it wasn't terribly complimentary, but he would go up to the bakery where you could get Spelding teas.
Well, but what is a Spelding? It's in the poem, but I don't get the reference.
That's right, yes. Well, it was the particular fish that the way they dried haddock or whiting here. And you gutted it twice over and laid it out and salted it, and it sat in a ring with the tails into the middle, I remember, and then they laid it out to dry either on flat racks or hanging up, and there's lots of old photographs showing you where they dried it, but unfortunately health and safety put an end to that because the blue bottles quite liked landing on, and there was no way.
You've tried it though, haven't you?
Oh, I loved Speldings when we came as a child. I just adored them, because they would be a gourmet thing now. You cooked them over a fire and barbecue would be ideal.
Beautiful wee beach. It's a perfect, it's a bit of a cliche, but you imagine a Cornish smuggling village. It ticks all of those boxes. We've got a handful of children from the local nursery down there having a ball by the water's edge. And you've got this pier, which I've read in local papers. It's a bit of a millstone round people's necks. Was it a white elephant? What was it built for? Because it never really worked.
Well, it was built for the fishing, but it was never actually finished. It should have gone out to the end of the Black Rock, which is called the Black Rig. But it never did, because the trouble was the steam trawlers came, and the yawls that we had here were no longer so suitable. So many of the fisher families here went to Torry, and you used to find a lot of the fisher names from this village, like King and Ritchie and Walker, Sangster, in Torry. And then they used to come back sometimes for their holidays here.
It's obviously in a bit of disrepair, but what amazes me about this whole village is the beach and the pier, the facilities, are all paid for by local people.
That's exactly right.
That must over be the massive years, fundraising.
Since 1957, that was the first gala, and that was Sir Douglas Ritchie got that together. And every year since then, I have been at a gala, and we have all sorts of things happening. Sometimes a lifeboat comes in, sometimes we have boaty races here, and we try and raise money. But, I mean, it's in a lot better repair now, and we have this pier committee who work really hard, and some of the village do some of the repairs.
It's a real community, Colliston. Let's explore it a wee bit more.
Elizabeth here, and I have to say, these sausages, cooked in an open fire, are coming on a treat. Possibly not as well as your langoustines or butterfly prawns or whatever it was, but, you know.
I'm just a bit apprehensive about how you're going to cook the frozen sausages. Obviously, you've done this before.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you having for starters?
What am I having for starters? I think I'll probably go for the chicken paste sandwich.
Excellent.
Chicken paste sandwich, or... Yeah, no, chicken paste sandwich, and then it'll be either a sausage butty or a bacon butty. For mains, and for desserts, I've got custard creams.
Okay. I've got a wee bit of starters now. I don't know, did you want any?
Well, what have you got?
We have. Well, we've got the bread, obviously. Mm-hmm. Help yourself.
That's the turmeric.
This is the turmeric.
Plat.
This is tear and share.
Is it?
And a bit of smoked salmon. And, whoo!
Look at that.
And some olives.
Across at the far end of the beach there, when the tide's right, the rocks stick out. And I have spent hour after hour after hour investigating those, looking underneath stuff. And when we were here the other day, it was frankly just too good an opportunity to miss.
Contend you never get too old for this.
It's just a joy raking about in rocks. See, there's a wee. This is a difficult one. See the thing beside the rock?
The thing beside the rock?
A bit of movement in the water there.
I can. It's just an immature fish, I think it is, possibly.
They're just eternally fascinating, and once you get your eye in, you can see so much. There's so much going on in there.
See, there's buckies in here, I can see that.
I always cannot resist shifting over rocks,
because quite often that's where you get the interesting stuff. There we go. Look, stuff skying about. Oh, fish.
Fish,
so. Fish. There
like
we go.
Like a mini shark.
It was. I think it was actually a baby dogfish.
That's what it looked like to me.
Yeah. See if you see. There it is. There. Wow. It is a baby dogfish. It's underneath there. See it?
Yep, I see it.
It's underneath the rock.
How exciting.
Shift that out. It says, oh, it's not happy. There's a whole swarm of them, actually. Look at them.
Goodness me, I've never ever seen that before.
Yeah.
See, every now and again you get the wee hermit crabs as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's such a seething maelstrom of battles and fighting and such exciting things, because they look quite quiet and amusing, but there's real battles going on there.
Well, the thing is, this is the intertidal zone. This is the point where, you know, it's covered at high tide. It's exposed at low tide, you know, and it is a battleground.
Yeah.
It's actually quite a tough environment for anything to thrive.
Yeah. I mean, the hermit crab I was chatting about earlier, they have a huge problem, because they get bigger, they need another shell. Mm-hmm. And so they've got to find another shell that they can go into and really quickly get in there. Mm-hmm. If they get it wrong, they've got to get back before somebody else steals their shell. And you can sit there watching them just open between shells for ages. And then you get the sea anemones.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you got that bright red tentacles. And I didn't know this till relatively recently, that they move about and they fight each other.
Uh-huh. They just get incredible slow motion.
They get right up close to each other. They've got these kind of teeth, for want of a better expression, and they'll suddenly headbutt the next one and tear a strip of skin off.
Uh-huh.
And then the loser will shuttle off.
Yeah.
Very unhappy.
Lift that rock there.
More dogfish.
That's it. Okay.
There we go.
Right, it's practically coming right out the water, the Egypt.
It's okay.
And there's a tiny wee crab. See the crab? There.
Yeah. So much going on. But the one thing that fascinated me most about rock pools are these guys.
Yes.
The limpet. Because the big predator of the limpet is the starfish.
Uh-huh.
And the matter of fact, there's one. Clinging to the rocks, you've got all these limpets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they move about too.
Yeah.
They kind of create little, almost like little grooves in the rock, and then shift, but they will come back to their base. I mean, how long has that thing been there?
What's amazing with the starfish when it comes up, because the starfish will come up and catch it with one of its suckers,
mm-hmm.
and pull it back just enough to inject its stomach in,
uh-huh.
dissolve the whole inside of the shell, and then pull its stomach back. But they can actually sense they're coming.
Uh-huh.
And little ones, as you say, will get up and try and run away.
Yeah.
And the starfish will try and catch them. But the big ones, like this guy,
mm-hmm.
they've been around for a long, long time. And what happens is a starfish comes up, they raise up, uh-huh. and it looks like a mushroom. And they see the serrated edge. It's like an angle grinder. Mm-hmm. And they'll do that, rocking back.
Well, just rubbing top of the starfish.
Rocking back and forth at the starfish till you can actually see bits of the starfish coming off. And the starfish says, nah.
Yeah, I give up.
So you've got a little ones running away and the big ones saying, bring it on. All in the one wee rock pool.
I'm going to have a hunt across here.
We go up to these as well, the dog whelk.
Uh-huh.
It's a nasty little thing. Comes along and it drills into the shell
uh-huh.
of
the other shellfish and scoops it out that way.
I feel lucky with this one. I like big rocks that sit high. Now look at that.
There's a baby crab.
Yeah, baby crab and lots of buckies. Effectively, it's a bucky nursery.
Remember we used to pick winkles when I was younger?
Uh-huh.
What a horrendous way to make a living.
What, you tried selling them?
Yeah, we did. We used to collect massive baskets of them.
Uh-huh.
For which we paid.
Probably seemed massive to you at the time.
Well, there were sacks, so it would be a kind of fertiliser bag full of winkles, and you would get equivalent to 30 shillings or something. Yes.
Three halfpennies and a copy of the Beano.
We were watching a whole pile of children earlier on from the local.
They probably stripped these pools out clean.
But you can see why. If you can get children down here, what a fantastic way to spend the day.
Yeah.
It's got to be something like that one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's have a go at this one.
Ready, steady, go.
Oh, there you go. Again.
It's hoaching with dogfish. Yeah. They must have just hatched out quite recently.
Yeah. They're not big. They're about an inch and a half long.
Because you see all these, what was it, maiden's purse, it's called?
Mermaid's purse. Yeah, the dogfish egg cases.
Egg cases.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
You wonder what they think. I mean, we're standing at the rock pools just now, and it's been bone dry, and it's starting to rain. And all of a sudden, in their saline environment, they're starting to get an infusion of fresh water. I wonder what difference that makes to them.
It's just such a tough place to live. They probably could not pick a harsher environment. You know, you think the sea's harsh, but this is really difficult. Fresh one minute, salt the next, a couple of crabs that haven't quite made it.
Nope.
But really big, massive limpets.
We're looking across to the cottage across there, which is probably the most traditional one, and the name of that one is Parton Cottage. You know, it's a local word for crabs, edible crabs.
I love that. I'm split up.
I just love that sound, the ebb and the flow of water through seaweed.
Only topped up by a winkle going back to its homeland.
So although neither of us are marine biologists and would struggle to determine what exactly was in there, it's still fascinating.
It doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah, it really doesn't matter.
Just fun all the way.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh, what's
there
this?
There we go. This is a butterflied langoustine.
I really want to say it's horrible. I really do, but it's fantastic. I'm sure my burnt sausages will be better, but this is delicious.
It's just a different thing, isn't it? That's quite pleasing, isn't it?
Mm. What is the spice in that?
It's a bit of Thai spice and black pepper and olive oil and a wee hint of garlic.
Yeah. For those of you who are settling down to a breakfast,
that's a good way to start.
All bran or something?
Yeah.
Tough. Anyway, Colliston, where we are today, is one of those places in Scotland that's just got a really strong, vibrant community. There's heaps going on here. And if you look to the far end of the beach there, something that is becoming increasingly regular as a sight round about the coast of Scotland, it's a St. Ailes skiff. And they've got the Colliston Rowing Club. And I fancied a shot the other night, hit really lucky in terms of the weather. John Hitchcock is the chairman of the club.
She's the Admiral Red Sox, and she's named after a retired Rear Admiral who used to live in the village and passed away a year or two before we built her. We built her as a community project, collected together a team from the village, and early days we were 20 folk who joined together to come and show interest in building a boat. We saw the idea up at Port Soy in 2013 and came back, and by October we'd received the kit, we'd bought the wood, and we were underway with building a boat. So our target was to be ready to launch and go and join in at Port Soy in 2014, which we achieved. which was great.
This is a St. Ailes skiff, and if there is such a thing as a type of boat going viral, this has gone viral.
Absolutely. It's been phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal, yeah. I think the original ones were just built for Anstruther, the Fisheries Museum, to just have a bit of playing locally. But now I think they've sold more than 200 kits for these
boats.
And they're sold all over the world. It's just fantastic. But this boat, the Admiral Red Sox, she joined in last year at the World Championships, which was in Strangford Lock in Northern Ireland. And there were 40 teams from all over the world, including a team from New Zealand there, from Holland, from Germany, Canada. That was just fantastic. And, we came 21st out of that, so we're well chuffed.
Very, very good.
Well chuffed with
very, very good.
With a little community with only about 200 people, 200 permanent residents, and about 30 to 40 people in the club, we were pleased.
I've been coming to Colliston since I was a wee boy, and you know, the far end of the beach, you have these ramps. Now, the ramp's probably at about 25, 30 degrees. If you'd remove the bricks underneath the wheels, because it's on a dolly at the moment, this thing would be doing about 40 miles an hour by the time hit the sea.
Yeah.
But it's actually on a winch at the back end, which is much more sensible.
Well, there's a lot of old-fashioned winches up there, so we've got a pulley on ours as well. A lot of fun.
Viv, those oars look new.
Yeah, they're fantastic. We've just bought them from Northern Ireland, from an oar maker there. So they've made quite a big difference. They're properly balanced. We hope they won't break.
So it's probably about 50 metres once you get onto the sand, down to where the water is at the moment. And obviously you're launching into the harbour. And then another 75 metres and you're out in the sea, basically. There you go. Rudder on.
Rudder on.
Roll up the trouser legs.
How did you get into this?
I think one day John said we fancy building one of these, so are you interested? And that was it. We built it. And I must admit, I was a bit cynical at first. I thought that we'd build it, probably be used for a year,
and then
sit,
get bored and
sit on the shore. Nope. 3 years on, and it's still as popular as ever.
Tell you what's a good indication of near constant use? Where you've got those pins in for the oars.
Oh, yeah, they're well worn.
See how worn that actually is.
Yeah, that's the thole pins.
Yeah.
Two were broken at the last race.
Such was the ferocity of your competitiveness.
Yes. Are you, you're coxing, John? Ewan, are you going in the bow then?
If you want, I'm easy. Whatever you want. Look,
it depends who wants to stroke.
So,
where do you want me to sit?
So we're thinking if we put you in the bows.
Okay.
And then put the ladies in the middle then.
Okay.
And John, you good to stroke?
Yeah. You want me in the bow, so
if you go in the bow.
If I go in first.
Yeah, if you
step in, try and step straight onto the centre.
Yeah, okay.
Because that's the strongest bit.
Do something sensible. Hold that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay.
That's it. If I was any more comfortable, I'd be asleep. He lied.
All right.
Absolutely. Tickety boo.
I find it quite comfy.
Yeah. Somebody's poking me with an oar.
Oh.
Stop it.
Okay, everybody oars. Give way. Together.
How far do you actually row in a one-er when you're training?
We do like 2 kilometre race simulations, I suppose you call them. With a start and a turn. And then we'll do a few practice turns, a few practice starts, you know.
And this is out. We're now out beyond the breakwater at Colliston and into the sea, which looked pretty flat till we got out onto the sea. It's actually not bad.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is sitting on benches, working away at their oars, aside from John, who, a bit like me, is sitting like Captain Bligh at the far end. I'm at the pointy end in the bow, and there is no seat. I'm kind of sitting on top of a bucket, a bit like Oor Willie. But it's actually very pleasant.
Okay, Mr. McElroy.
Yeah. You got any space in there yet?
What do you want?
I want that.
Alright, fair enough.
There's a black pudding to go with the scallops. Speyside black pudding?
Yep. And where are the scallops from?
I know it's a bit of a cliche having the black pudding with the scallops, but I'm really finding black pudding goes well with almost everything.
Yeah.
It's great.
I do like black pudding. Anyway, that was the Colliston Rowing Club. And they are fantastic, they're lovely people. Find out how we go on when I actually took an oar later on the programme.
See, it's lovely. Even there's a slight drizzle. And I'm quite looking forward to your sausages now as well. But it's just eating outside, isn't it?
Don't patronise me, McElroy.
Don't patronise you. I'm trying to inspire you to great things.
No, yeah, well, I thought I've gone for shop-bought sausages, pork and apple, admittedly. Now, if you actually marinate them in burnt butter like this on an open fire and then sprinkle them with sand, you get the authentic taste of Scotland. That's what a beach picnic's supposed to be, pal. None of your fancy pants nonsense.
It doesn't matter. If you served that up
at
a dinner party, you would have a kind of stunned silence and suddenly we'd have to get back for the babysitter.
I've had that.
But on the beach, it doesn't matter. You're outside. You're kind of it's much more forgiving and it tastes better.
But there must be a reason for that, because food definitely does taste better outside. And I have no idea why that happens. It doesn't matter what. And it's not to do with physical exercise either, because other than dragging the stuff out of the car and bringing it down here on the beach, we've done nothing. But it still tastes much better.
You know, there's another thing. Obviously, drink aware, drink responsibly. But a glass of whiskey, not that we've got any this morning for breakfast, outside.
You're kidding
me. It transforms.
You brought 15 types of shellfish and no whiskey.
You're hard to believe, but there it is. But yeah, if you're outside on a frosty afternoon, a wee nip out of hip flask, even if it's a kind of the world's cheapest blend, it tastes like sparkling malt.
When have you ever drunk the world's cheapest blend?
When you've provided it.
Yeah, well, fair enough. Fair point. Let's go back to Elizabeth Hay now, local historian, and get some more of the area's history. She's got some very interesting ancestors. Better still, she was carrying something really interesting with her. Dog roses with the rose hips just below us, and we are above basically the roof ridge of the cottages below us. The path just kind of winds up through this wee village, and this is typical.
Yes, this is a black shed. All the houses in the village, nearly all the fishermen, had black shades, and the reason they're black is because they were painted with archangel tar, which came from Archangel in Russia, and they caulked the inside of the boats, which were clinker built, and then so they had the stuff there, so they just did the shed with it, and it had a very strong smell that is still in my nose always, you know.
Associated with summer and things, you know.
Yes,
when the sun actually
right.
gets at it.
Well, yes, and we used to poke our fingers into the blobby bits.
I used to do that in the road as well. I used to roll it up, and just the smell of it was fantastic.
I know, but you can see the way it's built because they put the planks together and then that strip down there.
Right, it's nailed right across the gaps, essentially.
And you get that whole of the East Coast all the way down to the south of England. Quite often you get boats that are past or sell by date, turned upside down, made into sheds. And it's
They had that at the old castle. I always wanted one of them. There was never
We're on the main oil traffic route. Presumably that's just a constant noise for you, is it?
You don't notice it after a while. My little grandson, he's out looking for the helicopters as soon as he hears them, and I'm not really hearing them now.
Yeah.
When you've got a day of low cloud like this, it seems to capture the sound and bounce it straight back down onto the land.
This is interesting.
Well, that's the, as far as I know, that's the last Colliston Creole, and it went on, it was the women that carried these, and you can see how big it is, so that if you filled that full of fish or mussels, they walked from here to Newburgh to collect the mussels for the bait. And then when the fish was caught, they went with a big load of fish, and some of them went away as far as Old Meldrum. These women.
Old Meldrum's about, what, 20 miles from here?
Well, yeah, they went all over and to sell their fish and or barter it, because they would come home with eggs and cheese and things they couldn't get in the village.
They must have been hardy souls.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have lived as long as we
my relatives.
Were, you know.
So did they do that bit of carrying the men out to the boats to keep them dry?
Oh, yes, yes. They rolled up, there's a picture, an old picture of them with their bare legs, and that was to keep the men's leather boots dry. So presumably when you were looking for a wife, you looked for somebody with a bit of brawn.
Or a wife was looking for somebody my height.
I don't want a big man.
I would have died alone, frankly.
So what's this cottage called?
Well, I call it Aggie's at the Pint, because it's at the point. And it looks over the back of the spine of the pier. And it was an old lady called Agnes King, which was a fisher name, that lived in it. Now it's a holiday.
Well, the sea today is gunmetal blue. You now overlook yet another beach and yet another. There's basically a sea cave across there. It's fantastic.
It's called
lovely sound.
The Needle's Eye.
The Needle's Eye.
I tell you, it's one of those things, because you know, even travellers... Dr. Johnson coming up here described, you know, this is the most bleak countryside I have ever seen. And it's only when you get to the edge you realise how beautiful it is. You know, it's flat and dull, and then suddenly you're in a Walt Disney set. It's pirates, it's beaches, it's rocks.
That's right. Well, you see, I say buckins for connoisseurs, that you've got to hunt out.
See, not so much pirates here, but there's a lot of smugglers.
Yes, definitely, and my relatives smuggled as well.
What would you be smuggling?
Oh, gin, Holland gin. There's quite a history of it here. And of course the famous smuggler is Philip Kennedy, who's buried in the churchyard.
So I'm looking at the seals bobbing about there. It just looks like they're playing. But out there there's a wreck, isn't it?
Very special. Well, over the back of here there is.
Oh, right,
yes.
Let's go over there.
Right, we're just walking up to this little cove with sharp rocks, and this is where the wreck of a Spanish ship called the Santa Catarina was wrecked here. And it was meant to be going to the Isle of Errol with cannons and cannonballs, and one of the cannonballs we have in our family. It was brought up by a diver called Johnny Brand, who was working on the pier.
Show us your cannonball.
Well, you haven't let this woman carry a cannonball around here, have you?
Yeah, it's her cannonball. Very handy, portable size.
All right, wow.
Size of a cricket ball. Plenty. So how did you get that?
Well, my mother chatted up the diver called Johnny Brand.
Good woman, yep.
And he was bringing bits up. I mean, several times divers have gone down. And there are a number of cannons themselves that were brought up. And they went to various places. I think one went to Haddo, and at one time one was at Balmoral. There are two at the old castle. And the anchor and another one were in a museum in London for a while. But the Countess of Errol got them back.
So what century was this boat?
Oh, 16th probably.
So Spanish Armada?
No, it was always thought that it was one of the Armada boats, but it's been proved since then that in actual fact it wasn't. But it's the same era and the same sort of ship, which wouldn't have done terribly well in the northeast in a gale.
No.
Get a ram's home, what a dangerous way to make a living fishing must have been.
Oh, yes.
Because this is a hostile coastline.
It is. And you have to know the sea. And I went out with some of the old fishermen, and I know, you know, that you always go against the tide so that you drift back. and there are certain points that you learnt from them, one of which was called Castle in the Gut, which you could see the old castle in a slopey yeah. bit, and you knew where you were that way. And they were very respectful of the sea. And if there was a rumble begins, you know, the wind, then we were back in.
What I love about this part of the world, and I spend a fair amount of time here just walking about on the coastline, is the fact that you're walking through a lot of history.
And
it's, you know, we're talking about something from the 16th century that was wrecked off here. And there's helicopters go across all the time. You know, there are centuries of activity pass here all the time.
Yeah, that's right. And this, of course, was a quarry. And you can see the stones, and above that red there, that red line of soil, which is clay, that was pushed up in the Ice Age from Strathmore. And you know, when you're going down Strathmore, the soil there is red. Uh-huh. So the next time you drive down, you'll say to yourself, all right. I've seen that before somewhere.
I think I'll stick to cannonballs.
Well, I'll have that back, thank you.
You've met him before. When you hold the cannonball, you know, that size, and as you rightly pointed out, it's about the size of a cricket ball, it looks innocuous. What a damage that little thing could have caused.
I was thinking that as she was talking. Just imagine that hitting your body. Yeah. Well, you wouldn't imagine it for long, but...
No.
Yeah. What a brutal thing.
Yeah, nasty, nasty thing. Elizabeth Hay there, local historian. Just up the beach from here, well, about 3 miles that-a-way, there's Rock End, which used to be an old salmon fishing station. And I mention this because one of the things that you actually brought today is hot smoked salmon. Where did this one come from?
This is from White Hills as well. Mm. They smoke their own there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. That is nice. Twist a lemon on that.
Listen, I thought I was doing well, bringing the ketchup. But no. Anyway.
You can't have it without lemon. See, much as I love prawns, not a huge fan of lobster, hot smoked salmon is just one of the best things in the world.
It's a shame that you have to have lobster at this time of the day, isn't it? It's kind of de rigueur.
It's almost ready, so we'll see what it's like.
Well, we'll see how it goes. But Rock End, again, another area I used to walk and run regularly. Down there, there was, still is, the remnants of a salmon fishing bothy. Now, practically, I think anybody does salmon fishing on the coast nowadays. I think it's kind of out of bounds at the moment. There's a chap there that I met up with, Malcolm Forbes, and he spent 30, 40 really happy years doing just that.
Well, starting Lasuth, the Day Salmon Company, it was one of the biggest salmon fisheries in the Scottish coast. And then making her way up towards the Montrose area, the Esk, North and South Esk, that was all Johnston's. It was another big company. And then you'd the Hector. Hector had the station South Aberdeen, Cove, Newton Hill, and all that places. Previous to them was Bowries, that was another one of the big companies. And then you come up to Aberdeen Harbour Board, that was along the harbour, and they had three cobbles worked out of there. They had a boat good south to what they called the Grey Hopes. And they had a line of nets at the back of the North Pier, it was a line. And then they had the North Nets, what they called the North End of Mids. And that was the three boats. And then they had a couple of men on the beach working the flying nets.
What is this we're walking down to towards us now?
This is you coming up towards the site of the all 4V salmon boat. This was the fishing station at 4V.
I don't remember the bothy being roofed, but I remember there being a caravan down here.
Aye, well, the caravan was my boat, and the roof was just a flat roof. But it was my cousin did that. He started up his fishing again in 1977.
Uh-huh.
Was closed at the time of the war.
Uh-huh.
Because John Bruce, the man at Ain't the Fishing, him and his youngest boy, George Doddy, they called him, they worked here, and Dory was called up to the Navy for a war, so they closed the station down. As far as I can, I think the Home Guard used the both as a kind of headquarters down here.
Uh-huh.
And then it wasn't opened again until 1977, when a cousin of mine got in seeing the Bruces about the fishing, and they gave him a job to start it up again.
What was this building here?
This was the Bothy.
Uh-huh.
Bothy in the net store. And I can mind being here with my father, 1955. My father had the salmon station along with the tile, and I was a cobble here still, here for the time they stopped the fishing before I war. And it was a Skinner boat, and it was a favourite boat for a sandman here. And my father says, oh, I could buy that boat, so we go down to Cruden Bay to see Jimmy Bruce. It was been in the house to both of there. But I sat quite a while, I was just 10. And quite a while my father came back out. And they'd been at the John Barleycorn, and there was no deal, we didn't get the boat.
But it wasn't entirely wasted as a trip.
Well, not for them, it was not, no.
How did you actually do it? So your dog's panting all over the place. How did you actually do the fishing here?
Well, it was a sand station and a rock station, so along the sands, it was our stake nets, what we called jumpers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a doon size of the fly nets. The fly nets was like a Montrose Bay, and a while further back, it was nearly half fly nets, and that was a huge amount of stakes. But the jumper was a cut doon version of that, so I work at like 12 jumpers for here, for the both of here, right to the River Estuary. And worked bog nets on the sands here also, off the rocks. So the last few years I was working the whole fleet that was going up as far as Study Head, that's a war right up beside the pumping station at Twenty Fold. Yeah.
And these nets, essentially they were laid out on stakes because salmon swim parallel to the shore.
Yes, yes.
So they were laid out, and then there was like almost like little bag areas where the salmon actually got caught.
It was just like a big cage. And the net that come for the cage shoreward was kind of the leader, it would lead the fish in, you see. So, like if it was flood tide, the tide coming from the north. We I said that the sand fishings was flood tide fishings, and the rock scenes were ebb tide fishings. So,
mm-hmm.
And the flood
one tide coming in, the other tide going out.
Aye, that's right, aye. So, that's the way they work it. And in the springtime, you had a lot of bad weather and damage, and but in the early days, it was worth the risk because the price of the fish now was all right. You can't walk back. But in the latter years, we wasn't starting so early in the spring, and because you wasn't getting the prices for the fish. And the damage that you was getting your gear and all was
costly.
Again, if you got a big wreck, mm-hmm. with a big wreck in the mid-80s, in the summertime.
Define wreck.
Well, just heavy sea, and you would get with it if it was a big tide, like the strength of tide plus the weight of the sea, especially northerly sea, you'd have gotten broken stakes, your mm-hmm. guys broken, and like the bog nets, pulling anchors, mm-hmm. broken ropes, and your gear was either washed onto the rocks or else broken away from the rocks and swelling away at the sea.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd retrieve all that and took them ashore and assess them and mend them and clean them. And,
yeah.
So a lot of work, and quite often you'd lift the anchors again as well and put back in stakes.
That dog is fairly enjoying chewing a plastic bottle. You couldn't find a quiet one, dog, could you? Come on. How long did you actually work here?
Well, I came here in 1980 and left. Well, the last fishing season was 1999. The company kept me on until February 2000 until I got a job.
Uh-huh.
But the last year, I was just here myself working jumper nets. I worked 9 jumper nets along the beach here.
This must have been like being in a different world, working down here.
Oh, this was just... I used to come here in the springtime in 1980. I still bed in Aberdeen at that time. Bed here a whole week. Then get home on a Saturday. And then in the summertime, I took a wife and my kids. I had four lasses. And they all come out here. This was their summer holidays.
This is like Famous Five, though. I mean, just to explain, we've walked out of the dunes, past the Bothy.
there is, I mean, we're at Rock End, the beach heads towards the River Eithen here.
Yes.
But it's a good mile away before you get to it, and it's just golden sands.
Yes.
There's us down on the beach, and the dog, obviously.
It's just, it's about a mile and a half. Before I stopped, when you come down here, you'd have just seen a line of nets all the way along, right along to the estuary. The jumper nets, you sometimes two in a line, sometimes three, depending on how the sandbanks was moving and stuff.
This is actually one of my favourite places in Scotland. I love this section of beach. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that it's, you know, it's just slightly remote. You don't get so many people down here.
No.
Fantastic part. And I know what you did must have been hard work. But I envy you it.
Oh.
You know, just the peace and quiet down here. And
it was a way of life. It wasn't a job. I was here myself doing jobs. There used to be six of a crew in this station. And I never had six of a crew here. I was lucky getting family. I had two brother-in-laws, my wife's two brothers. They were never here together, but one season or another, I would give them a phone and say, you come out the fishing this year. And things was getting difficult because in the early days, when you was a salmon fisher, at the end of the season, you just get and got a job. There was jobs all the way. At the trawling, at the building, and labouring, and you just get in only jobs going, oh, I started Monday, and you did a job over the winter, and then you started the fishing again. And there was salmon fishers, that was men that could sort nets and they couldn't the job outside in. But coming into the 80s, you know, I think it was getting more difficult to get experienced men. And some of them was good lads, but they weren't fishermen. And they didn't ken about nets or nothing, you ken. And so it come to be, you loved the job and the way of life as much, it you just wanted to do it. And as long as you made a living, but when it come to be it, you couldn't make a living, you had to stop, you ken. It was a privilege for me to do this job, a job that my grandfather and my father did. And loved it, missed the job every day, but just to be in a place like this, you can, this was special. This was a special. You know.
Former salmon fisherman Malcolm Forbes there, you know, and it's what, late 1990s when the salmon fishing station actually closed, like a lot of them did back at that time. And all these years later, you can still see how much he misses it. It was a life that he absolutely loved.
Yeah, you can still see traces of it right throughout the northeast of Scotland. Mm-hmm. And there are very sound ecological reasons for that. But you kind of, you know, the tradition, the songs, the lifestyle, you know, it's a bit sad that it's gone because it just stopped within a couple of decades.
Well, you say sound ecological reasons why it's actually gone, but the salmon fishing stations have been gone predominantly for 20 years. The number of salmon in the rivers continues to go down in a lot of rivers, so there is a problem. It may not necessarily, I mean, certainly the salmon fishing stations wouldn't have helped, but it, you know, that I don't think it's the whole story.
Talking of problems.
What's wrong with my sausages?
Well, I was a bit worried about my black pudding.
Aye.
It was looking a bit. But I've run out of barbecue power, so I'm going to take
we need to put more wood in this.
Take my scallops
yeah.
and cook them in the black pudding mm-hmm. and sausage fat, because I think that's going to be
that's your actual job,
fantastic.
Isn't it?
But yeah.
You've got the black pudding.
We've got some lobster here.
This is lobster.
It might be slightly overdone.
Ah, that's a beautiful meat, actually. It's quite a sweet meat.
It's not quite as sweet as a langoustine, but
no, I actually prefer that.
See, you do have expensive tastes.
I do have expensive tastes. Right, well, this is it. It's always been my problem.
Mm.
We'll get round to eating some of those sausages shortly, because I know they went in slightly frozen, but they must be cooked by now. Well, let's go back to the rowing club here at Colliston, because a lovely bunch of people. They're one of the groups that have got one of these St. Ailes skiffs, and they're specifically designed for rowing. They come in kit form, you build them yourselves, you get on with it, and then you race them. But it's not just about racing. We'd been out in the open water. I'd been sitting in the bow of the boat on the wrong way up in a bucket. It wasn't even a proper rower willy moment. And then risking life and limb, I swapped seats with a guy sitting in front of me who coincidentally was also called Ewan. He sat in the bucket, I sat on the bench, took an oar, and this is what happened.
So if we just sit here for a moment.
How many times a week do you actually train like this?
Try at least train 4 or 5 times, but it all depends really on the weather. You know, sometimes you can get a real nice, glorious northeast day, but in the sea state it'll just be really choppy and just unsafe to go out. But perfect conditions, we'll try to be out 4 or 5 times a week. Usually do sort of like competitive training on a Thursday night, Saturday morning, sometimes a Sunday morning, weather permitting. And then we try and do a couple of social rows, you know, just out enjoying the sea. Maybe like, for example, on a Tuesday night, it's like the gentleman's row. So we'll make a flask of tea, make some pieces, and try and do a long row and stop somewhere like maybe Winifold or down at the beach, go ashore, have a wee picnic, and back out in the boat again, you know.
Uh-huh. And I'm sure this isn't the object of the exercise. It seems to be the object of the exercise is having fun, but yeah. Have you noticed a difference in your fitness?
Definitely, yeah. You know, you're out here for me for a half an hour doing like heavy training, you really do build up a sweat, and it's good cardiovascular fitness, and it's good for the upper body and your legs. So yeah, I definitely notice a difference. Okay. You know.
Okay, are we ready? Races start then, guys, and then we'll launch into a pyramid after we've settled down. Okay, together, give way. Attention. Let's go! 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That's great. Keep it going, guys. Nice and steady. Catch your breath. Keep breathing. Slow right down. Keep your breathing going. Get your breath back. Keep those muscles moving. And oars. Come on, guys. Very good.
Can I just check I got this right? You went to Port Soy, saw the boat, thought it was a good idea to buy one and build one, and now you get to sit at the pointy end and shout, and they have to do all the work.
You started it.
Sounds about right.
We'll call it the shouty seat.
Yep. Excellent.
Everybody oars, give way. Together. Good guys.
This is going to be one of these really rubbish bits of radio because I'm now on the lower and I cannot row and talk at the same time.
Watch the, make sure you're watching the stroke. Front off. Man at the back.
Sorry.
Think about your technique.
that's not going to take long, Viv.
I can't wait to see those oars jumping into the water. Stomach muscles tight.
Now you're asking.
Come on, feel those stomach muscles are working the core. Good. And ease off.
Oh, well fallen behind there.
Well, you're good. Ooh, natural. And pause.
Just like that.
Very good. Thank you very much, Viv.
Good man. I enjoyed that, actually. I genuinely enjoyed it. It was good.
Excellent. Well, yeah. Well done.
Thank you very much for that. My genuine thanks to the Colliston Rowing Club. I had a fantastic time out there, so much so that I'm seriously considering actually going and joining them. They're only about 25 minutes drive away from me, and it's a lot of fun. It's good exercise.
It's just incredible the way it's taken off in Scotland. It's fantastic. Right, we're getting to...
Look at this. You've got the scallop shells, you've got the scallops, you've got a wee bit of black pudding, and better still, my sausages are now properly burnt. That's the important thing.
Right, well, I'm going to try a bit of scallop first, and then I'll go get further. Your sausages, they look fantastic.
Yeah.
Go. It's a bit hot.
I don't think you can really fully enjoy a sausage sarnie out in the great outdoors without brown sauce, and thankfully I had the presence of mind to bring some. So although you're posh and I'm plebeian this week, I think it's working.
Well, I'm going to try your sausages, obviously.
Yeah. Do you want some ketchup?
No, I'm going to try some mayonnaise with a hint of paprika on the top. on sausages? Yeah. It's perfect.
You're scaring me now.
Right.
Okay. Anyway.
I'm surprised they're not burnt. Really surprised.
Bearing in mind how absolutely awful the morning was in terms of rain, this has actually been exceptionally pleasant, and it just goes to show that even on a day that isn't bright sunshine and it is overcast, you can have fun and have a nice time and have a nice meal. You know, it's just a nice place to be, Colliston. Lots of people think that. Here's Elizabeth Hay with a poetic farewell from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen. Thanks for listening.
This is a poem called Colliston Calling, written by John Robertson again. Really for people who left the village and yearned for it. Did you hear a voice in the wind just then? Did you stop and listen and hear it again? Did memory stir for a moment or two? Could it be Colliston calling to you? In a busy street in some distant town, you hear a whisper the clamour can't drown, compelling above the traffic's roar, and Colliston calls to you once more. Or perhaps in a wood fire flame, you see a face, a place, a name, and could a swirling wisp of smoke in you some memory evoke? Or a yearning wheresoe'er you roam, it's Colliston calling you back home.